2 Timothy 2, starting from verse 14, remind them of these things, charging them before the Lord not to strive about words to no profit, to the ruin of the hearers. Be diligent to present yourself approved to God, a worker who does not need to be ashamed, rightly dividing the word of truth. But shun profane and idle babblings, for they will increase to more ungodliness, and their message will spread like cancer. Hymenaeus and Philetus are of this sort, who have strayed concerning the truth, saying that the resurrection is already past, and they overthrow the faith of some. Nevertheless, the solid foundation of God stands, having this seal: the Lord knows those who are his, and let everyone who names the name of Christ depart from iniquity. As mentioned, we are coming to a new series, a short series on the 5 points of Calvinism. This evening, we want to begin with an introduction to the 5 points of Calvinism. It is basically a historical introduction, bringing us to understand how this term, the 5 points of Calvinism, came about and what it is all about. And of course, we want at the end of this series to realize that it is important to be clear about this doctrine. It will not do for those who are in a so-called Reformed church not to know what are the 5 points of Calvinism. And some surprisingly have been in so-called Reformed churches, but they have never heard of what are the 5 points of Calvinism. And that is tragic. We don't want that to happen. And if you want to be used by God in the teaching of God's word, understand well the teaching of these 5 points of Calvinism. So with that, we come to consider what we are dealing with. We want to note that one characteristic of the Reformed faith is belief in the system of salvation called Calvinism. We believe that it is the system taught in the Bible. So you understand that the Bible is a system. It is not open-ended. You know what is meant by open-ended and what is a closed system. Right? We believe that the Bible is a closed system. It is consistent in itself. It doesn't contradict itself. Right? One part explains the other. So it's not open-ended. It doesn't teach some vague things and then let you choose which you want to believe in. No, it clearly teaches truth in an absolute way. Often the problem is with us not clearly understanding the truth. So we find inconsistencies here and there, but the inconsistencies are in our mind and not in the Bible. We believe that God is not a God of contradiction. He speaks with one voice. The Bible's teaching is a system. Then the Bible contains many teachings, one of which is the doctrine of salvation. So the doctrine of salvation is like one arm of the body. The body has the head, the body has the two arms, the body has the eyes and the nose, the limbs and so on. So we consider the Bible as a whole, is complete as a body. But there is one arm which deals with salvation. So the doctrine of salvation is an important doctrine. So what do we understand concerning the Bible's teaching on salvation? So this is a broad subject. But in today's world, the problem of a few centuries ago is still with us. Namely, do we believe in Calvinism or do we believe in the excesses on both sides? One excess is that of Arminianism, which emphasizes human responsibility at the expense of divine sovereignty. At the other end is hyper-Calvinism, sometimes called high-Calvinism. It emphasizes divine sovereignty at the expense of human responsibility. So Calvinism, we believe, is the biblical system. It does not take half of hyper-Calvinism and half of Arminianism and combine them together. No, it doesn't combine things in an artificial manner like that. But rather, it teaches clearly that God is sovereign. And is sovereign in such a way that human responsibility is subsumed under sovereignty. Okay? But human responsibility truly is responsibility, because God holds us responsible for how we live. How it is that human responsibility can exist together and subsume under divine sovereignty is a mystery. There are those who try to reconcile the two and along the way put the two as though they are in tension with one another. I personally don't like that construction of the relationship between the two, because it makes the two as equal to one another and contending with one another, such that at a critical point somewhere along the line, the two will break apart because they are against one another. You see, you put them in tension. Okay? But I say, no, they are not in tension. They are not under tension. Instead, they exist harmoniously. And they don't exist side by side as though both are equal. No. Human beings cannot be equal to God. Okay? So God is truly sovereign in his power. And he created man with human responsibility. He holds us responsible. So divine sovereignty is over human responsibility. But human responsibility is truly responsibility. We are really held responsible. See, how that can be, we have difficulty in understanding. But the point is that it is a teaching taught in the Bible, and along the way we experience it in our life. We must realize and recognize that God is truly sovereign over his creation. And we must also come to realize in our experience that we are held responsible, and the Bible declares that we are responsible for how we behave before God. Okay? So we believe that Calvinism is that system of salvation taught in the Bible. Then that system is the whole arm. We summarize the doctrine of salvation by these 5 points, which are like the 5 fingers of the whole arm. So don't wrongly think that the 5 points of Calvinism is the total doctrine of salvation. The 5 points of Calvinism is only a summary of the total doctrine of salvation. Okay? So the 5 points are like the 5 fingers on the hand. The whole doctrine of salvation is the whole arm. Okay? So we are not considering the whole arm, we are considering the 5 points, how it came about, why it is called 5 points, and why it's important to us. Okay? And these 5 points of Calvinism, which summarizes the doctrine, the biblical doctrine of salvation, has been called the doctrines of grace, because these 5 points emphasizes the grace of God in the salvation of sinners. So we know that the word grace basically means God shows his mercy to those who do not deserve it. So God shows his mercy to undeserving sinners in salvation. So salvation is by the grace of God, and the 5 points of Calvinism may therefore be called the doctrines of grace. And please take note that along the way there are those who prefer to use the singular doctrine instead of doctrines. The claim is that they belong together. You study the 5 points separately, but always remember that they are one doctrine. So therefore they say, you know, it is the doctrine of grace. But be that as it may, acknowledging that there are those who prefer to use the singular, we nevertheless should understand what we are meaning when we are studying here. We use the word doctrines or points in a plural form because we want to analyze each point in turn and then later see them as a whole. Okay? So this just to introduce you to the subject. And in this introduction, the historical introduction, we want to consider how the term, the 5 points of Calvinism arose, how it came about, and what are they, and why they are important. So this evening we want to focus more on how the terms came about. Then in the subsequent talks we will consider what they are, and by the end of the series we want to understand why they are so important to us. Okay? Now, we go back to history. We consider the rise of Pelagianism. what happened is that after the time of the apostles, when the last surviving apostle had died, their disciples, the disciples of the Lord, continued to preach and the gospel spread. And there were many able defenders of the faith who rose up to propagate the truth and defend it against attacks from various people. And along the way, we have to say that overall, the church leaders were not careful, and a number of them were influenced by pagan philosophy. In the attempt to counter wrong teaching, you get too near to them, and along the way, not being careful, you begin to adjust your teaching in such a way that it conforms to some degree to pagan philosophy. So that can happen. See? So we are in the world, we don't try to avoid the world. We are in the world, but we are not of the world. In the world, we want to act as salt of the earth and light of the world. So those who try to run away from the world, we say you are unbiblical. That approach is wrong. That's why we are a bit concerned about otherwise honest and respectable Christians. We just differ from them when they emphasize so much on Christian education and homeschooling and so on. Okay? We say, no, not in our situation. We don't want to overprotect our children. Okay? We believe that it is not wrong for us to send our children to public schools. Yes, evolution along the way might be taught, but we teach our children that evolution is not right. But we also show to them from the Bible a better explanation. We want them to be strong, to know the difference between truth and error, so that they can survive anywhere in the world, rather than to overprotect them. See, you want to prevent them from being exposed to evolution. Then what else do you want to prevent them from? Oh, you want to prevent them from being exposed to Islam. But when they go to local universities, remember, Islamic studies is a compulsory subject. You see? Then you want to avoid the influence of the Muslim prayer. Then you have to move your house sufficiently far from the nearest mosque. You see? Then when you move, you discover you're next door to a Buddhist temple. So you have to move some more. You see? And forever you're moving and moving. You see? You want to overprotect your children, you wouldn't succeed. You see? And those who are overprotected generally are weak. You think they are strong. You see, you teach them to be such civil people and they conform to your way of behavior. But they don't know what the world is like. It's foolish you, you know. You raise up your children to be softies, huh? And cruel. Yes, cruel on you. Huh? You love them in the wrong way. One day they have to go for national service. One day they have to work elsewhere. And you discover they can't stand in the face of differences of opinions, in the face of people of different views. You see? So we say we are rather concerned about those who have that approach. So we believe that we should interact with the world. But as we interact with the world, do be careful. Learn from history. Because as you interact with the world and you bring the truth to bear and you are trying to win people to Christ instead of fearing them and trying to retreat all the time. See, we are on the aggressive, we move forward. They should fear us more than we fear them. You see, why should we fear Islam? Why should we fear Hinduism? Why should we fear Buddhism? We live in the midst of these people. Interact with them. Be friendly with them. And they are more afraid of us than we are of them. We have the truth. You see? So why withdraw? You see? So we bring the truth to interact with others. But as you interact, be careful. You see, you want to adjust to meet their needs. And along the way, in your adjusting, you be careful. Don't adjust your truth. Be very careful. Okay? So that was what happened. And when you study the first four centuries of Christian history, you discover the so-called apologists among the Christian leaders arose to counter various wrong teachings. There were different schools of apologists that arose. So we, God willing, we'll learn a little of this in a series of studies on church history. We haven't covered church history for some time. See? But some of the men who along the way were unwittingly influenced were actually champions of the faith. They fought against heresies and fought against perversions of the truth. If not for their work, the church would have been weakened considerably. There would be more victims, or many Christians would have been badly affected. So examples was this man, Tertullian of Carthage. He died around about the year 220 AD. Then there was Hilary of Poitiers, who died around about 368 AD. Then there was Ambrose of Milan, who died around about 397 AD. So you realize that it's around about that period, within the first four centuries. Now, where is Carthage? Yeah, you hear of it. Yeah. Then you, in those days, if you follow shows and stories like Cleopatra, you know, and people like that, you see Antony and Cleopatra and so on. Those are like sound like myths, mythical stories, but actually they are based on historical facts. You see? They may be stories, but they actually use conditions of that time. It occurs during that period. So during that time, the first four centuries of the church, the Roman Empire spread throughout northern Africa all the way to North India, you see, and covering the Middle East. And today's Turkey, for example, was the province of Asia that we read about in the book of Acts. So Asia in the book of Acts is not China or not India. You know? Asia in the book of Acts is actually Turkey. If you look at the map, Turkey is quite a huge piece of land. See? So that was the province of Asia. Then in Africa, we don't realize, perhaps we think that Egypt was a strong power in the past, but we don't realize that Algeria, Tunisia, all those were centers of learning and trade, and people were traveling everywhere, and they were in those days thriving places. So where is Tunisia? You see, imagine in front of you the map of North Africa. You have Egypt in front of you. Towards the right is Algeria, then further towards the right is Tunisia. Then today there is the city of Tunis. In the suburb of the modern city of Tunis is the ancient ruins of Carthage. Carthage was located there. Okay? And Poitiers is in France, and Milan is in Italy. So because these are still well-known places, so we have no difficulty identifying in our mind roughly where they are. But a place like Carthage, you'll be wondering where this is. So for that reason, I just briefly mentioned that it is actually in Tunisia. So these were well-known church leaders who fought for the faith. But along the way, we see influences of pagan ideas coming in. Yeah? And then around about that time, there was a British monk by the name of Pelagius. He's full name and title was actually Pelagius Breto Morgan. He was born around about 360 AD and lived up to 418 AD. Now this Pelagius went to settle for a long time in Rome, and he lived an ascetic life. And here again, you think in those days, it's so primitive, you know, people didn't travel much. You think they were so ignorant of things. But remember, long before that in China, writing had been in existence for thousands of years. And the Egyptian culture was as old as China. So in Egypt, Moses was raised up in a palace and he already knew writing, and he was writing poems and songs. Hey, remember in the time of the apostles and after that, writing was already very well developed. Culture was everywhere. See, don't get the wrong idea that people were so primitive, they were wearing animal skins and living in caves. See? That's not the case, you see. So at that time, people were traveling around to engage in studies and in sports, in business, especially business, they travel, you see. Then the army conquered, and then soldiers would be sent to different parts of the frontiers. And then along the way, influences of various kinds come to and fro. You know, the soldiers influence the local people influence the soldiers. So things like that happen. Okay? So this man, Pelagius, was actually in Rome, and he was a scholar. He was actually a man who tried to live a godly life, and he belonged to a group called the ascetics. They believed in living a frugal type of life, eating fruits perhaps, eating no eating of meat, and no eating of living a luxurious life, living very simple life, an ascetic type of life. But he was known to be a powerful preacher. Okay? So when he preached, people found power in what he was saying. His arguments came so powerfully in the hearing of people, and people were convinced by what he was, easily swayed by what he was saying. Okay? So this man, Pelagius, he came up with the doctrine of salvation, which was peculiar to himself, and later became known as Pelagianism. So his followers, of course, he had followers, and then as he wrote and taught, you see, his teaching spread. And we can summarize Pelagianism under 4 points. Firstly, at the fall of man, Adam harmed only himself, not his posterity. Okay. And to him, there's no such thing as original sin. So if you know the Bible's teaching, straight away you know that this is contrary to accepted teaching of the Bible. Yeah? We believe Adam was the representative head of the human race. So when he fell, the whole human race fell. So where do we find our sinful nature? Where did it come from? We know it came from Adam and Eve. And there's such a thing as original sin, how it got transmitted down to us. But Pelagius taught differently. He said at the fall, Adam harmed only himself, see, not his posterity. Yeah? And he denied that there's such a thing as original sin. Then the second point is that man's will is free, free to choose good or bad, right or wrong. It is up to man to do good or evil. Then point number three in his teaching, God's grace is given to those who show that they deserve it. So you have to show yourself deserving. So you must work hard at being holy. You must pray many times and things like that. Read the Bible many times. Show to God that you deserve it. Then God will show his grace to you. And he claimed that the grace of God can be resisted. When God begins to speak to you, you can resist. You can struggle against your conscience and fight against what the Bible is saying to you. See? So that is his claim. And fourthly, God's decree of election and reprobation is based on foreknowledge. To him, he defines foreknowledge as knowing beforehand. You see, so he claimed that God knew what you are going to be like, whether you are going to be hardworking or godly, or you will pray many times a day, you will read the Bible regularly. So God foresaw that you were going to be such a person, so he chose you. Or you're going to be a rascal and you're not going to be obedient to him, and therefore God did not choose you. So there's this idea of foreknowledge. His understanding of foreknowledge is like that. See? And we are going to learn later on that the foreknowledge, the word foreknowledge in Romans 9 there is not information that we know, but rather the word to know is to love. You see? So God loved his people beforehand. So we are going to learn about that. We'll show that that is the right understanding. But many people in the past, along the way, wrongly took it as information that you know beforehand. So that's knowledge. You see? And then his claim was that Christ died for all men. Yeah? And it's up to us, therefore, to know Christ, to follow him. You see? He sets the example for us. And if we can follow him closely, then we will progress on from one degree of holiness to another. So salvation basically is dependent on your own effort. Christ has done his part, but you must now exert your part. You see, you must do your part to imitate him and to follow him. See? So that basically is the teaching of Pelagius. Then we move on to point number three. There was this man called Augustine. He was raised up by God to challenge Pelagianism. So Augustine against Pelagianism. Augustine was the bishop of Hippo in northern Africa from the year AD 395 to AD 430. He became quite well known in church circles, and he was known for his godliness. And even up to today, if you mention the name of Augustine of Hippo, many people will know that he wrote his book called The Confessions. The full title is The Confessions of St. Augustine, but it's often called The Confessions of Augustine. Okay? Then there was the book The City of God. He wrote a number of other books, but these are two well-known books of his, The Confession and The City of God. So you talk about the City of God, you Google City of God, straight away the name of Augustine will come out. You see, it's a classic. So Augustine, as we have noted, was raised up by God. We know that it's God's doing. He had quite a colorful life. You should read his biography. You know, you have to transport yourself to those days and customs of that time and how people live. And his mother played a crucial role in his upbringing and also in his faith. His mother was a godly woman, prayed for him regularly. And Augustine is in his early days tried to rebel and try to run away from God. See? Then he said that one day it is as though God spoke to him, yeah, and told him, take the book and read. Take and read. You see? So he looked around, oh, there was a book there. So he took and read. So it is through reading the Bible that he came to faith in Jesus Christ. Okay? So it's quite an interesting story. And he went on to develop. He was, you know, the providence of God in his life was such that along the way he finally rose to become the bishop, the pastor of the church in North Africa. And when Pelagius began to teach such wrong doctrine, Augustine was just the right man prepared to know, to understand what Pelagius was teaching, to realize how wrong it was and how dangerous it was. Augustine was just the man for the hour to counter this man Pelagius. See, there would be one or two others who were countering Pelagius at the same time, but the main man raised up by God to challenge Pelagius' teaching was Augustine. And Augustine wrote and taught on what he believed to be the true teaching of the Bible concerning salvation. And Augustine's teaching can be summarized under 4 points, contradictory to the teaching of Pelagius, in contradiction to the teaching of Pelagius. So point number one, at the fall, all mankind sinned in Adam. Human nature became totally corrupt. Then point number two, by Adam's sin, human free will was totally lost. Man can will only evil. He can exercise his will, but his will, because it's tied to his sinful nature, will always act according to his nature. His nature is sinful, therefore when he decides, he chooses what is evil. Okay? Point number three, if man does any good, it is because of God's work of grace. So man is not totally as bad as he is now. Each person can be worse than what he is. You think you're so good compared to others, but actually you're capable of more evil. You look at an evil person, he is actually capable of even worse evil. You see? So it is God's grace restraining us from becoming evil. Then along the way, we look at the good. It's not that man is totally useless. There's no good that comes out from him. No, the image of God is still upon him. And if he does anything good, it is because of God's grace operating in the person. So since man can do nothing without grace, so he can do nothing against it. Therefore, the grace of God is irresistible. It's a simple statement, but it involves clever logic. And such conclusion has to come from someone who has already taught things broadly and deeply. You see? So think of it. He's just saying, since man can do nothing without grace, so he can do nothing against grace as well. You see? And therefore it follows that the grace of God is irresistible. Okay? Point number four, from eternity, God made a free and unconditional decree to save some. So he did not make a decree to save everyone, to save some. See? And that decree is free and unconditional, not conditioned upon what God foresaw in man. Christ came into the world and died for the elect, the chosen ones only. That was Augustine's teaching. So you see that Augustine was raising each point in contradistinction from Pelagius. He was actually trying to counter the teaching of Pelagius. He was establishing what had all the while been held to be the Bible's teaching. But because no one had attacked the Bible by the Bible's doctrine of salvation the way Pelagius had, so therefore the doctrine of salvation had not been put the way Augustine had. Okay, but because Pelagius rose and attacked the doctrine of salvation in that way, this Augustine had to put the Bible's doctrine of salvation in such a way as it clearly stands in contrast to Pelagius' doctrine. So when you look at Augustine's doctrine, the doctrine of salvation point for point, you discover along the way it is taught in the Bible, it's in the writings of the other church leaders, except that they have not been put together like that to be shown as a system, because there had been no one who attacked the doctrine of salvation the way Pelagius did. You see? So now because Pelagius attacked the doctrine of salvation the way he did, God raised up this man, Augustine, to counter him, and therefore we have Augustinism. So Pelagianism was condemned by the councils of Carthage in 418 AD and the council of Ephesus in 431 AD. Now what are these councils? These are the so-called ecumenical councils. We mustn't be stumbled by the word ecumenical. Today the word ecumenical is negative. It has a negative connotation. And as a Reformed and Separatist church, we have nothing to do with the ecumenical movement, the modern ecumenical movement. The modern ecumenical movement basically wants visible structural unity at the expense of truth. They say, don't talk about differences, let's overlook our differences, let's show rather what are we holding common, what we are united about. Let's focus on what we agree on. Don't look at what we disagree about, and let's come together as one, show the world that we are one. And the argument seems so very convincing. We are fighting a common enemy, and the devil is behind the worldly system and is powerful. We must all unite, otherwise we will be easy prey to the devil. And everywhere Christians are suffering and being attacked. So let us get together. Let's show the world that we are one. So we can speak out against error together, and we can stand together to help one another in times of trials. So the arguments are so powerful, and many churches and many church leaders succumb to this type of argument. But along the way, they don't realize that by overlooking truth, you are going against the teaching of the Bible. The Bible tells us to be faithful to the truth of the Bible. The Bible tells us to separate from those who pervert the truth. See? And therefore, by joining the modern ecumenical movement, you are actually breaking the clear teaching of the Bible. Then you don't realize that truth does matter. It matters supremely, and it will affect your faith. See? And truth are all linked together. When you are wrong on something, it leads to other things. And certain truths are fundamental to the faith. Yeah. So you cannot compromise on these fundamentals of the faith. So on certain things where honest, sincere Christians differ about, we can along the way assess how serious it is and have fellowship with such. But we must be very careful that those who deny the truth, especially when it affects what we regard as fundamental truths of the Christian faith, we will have to resist them. We not only separate from them, we have to expose them. See? Warn our people about them. We can't go and forcibly change them. We cannot. We believe in the liberty of conscience. We believe in each individual being answerable to God. See? But for our own people, we must warn them and show to them why others are propagating wrong teaching. So ecumenism of today, the ecumenical movement of today, is a movement that tries to have visible structural unity at the expense of truth. For that reason, we have nothing to do with them, the World Council of Churches, and in Malaysia, the CFM, Christian Federation of Malaysia, they are basically ecumenical. Okay? We respect certain individuals in that movement. You see, we don't understand why they are in such a movement. They disagree with us on the need to separate. But there are true believers in their midst. But we, as an organization, they as an organization, is something that we would not have fellowship with. As a church, we would not have fellowship with such churches. And such individuals will never be invited to speak in our church. And we don't want to stand on the same platform with them. See? There are certain things we share in common, such as when a disaster strikes, then we have to stand side by side, just both with professing believers as well as even non-believers together. We have to do our part in disaster relief and social work and so on. But that is different from standing together, proclaiming the truth. When you stand on the same platform to teach the Bible's teaching, you are giving the impression that the differences between us do not matter. But we say, no, they do matter. We want to be faithful to God's word, and we know that differences on doctrines can be very dangerous. So this is the modern ecumenical movement that manifests itself in many sub-movements throughout the world. But now we are dealing with the so-called ecumenical councils of the past, which is different from a movement. They were councils. They were conferences, as it were, held. And in those days, the Roman emperor, after the time of Constantine, interfered quite a lot in church affairs. So when Constantine saw that the churches were divided, he wanted unity. That's why he himself professed faith. And that's why he passed the law to tolerate all religions. And because he himself professed to be a Christian, many pagans left their paganism and joined the church. See? And the church became weakened with numbers coming in like that. See? But Constantine saw that the churches were often quarreling and in disagreement on this and that. So there were times when he interfered. He called the bishops together. Okay, you bishop of this church, you come together. Come and have a conference and discuss this matter. Come to a conclusion. See? And although the state interfered in the life of the church like that, but nevertheless, it was the bishops themselves who discussed spiritual things. They came to the conclusion which doctrine was wrong and what was the right one. Okay? So whenever an error arose, a council would be called. Okay? And there was a council of Carthage in 418 AD to discuss Pelagianism, and they came to the conclusion that Pelagianism was against the Bible's teaching. It was not biblical. Then Pelagianism continued to exist for some time. The followers continued to agitate and disturb the churches. And another council was called in Ephesus in 431 AD. And again, that council examined and re-examined everything and came to the same conclusion. Pelagianism was anti-biblical. It was not the Bible's teaching. Okay? Then many centuries passed until we come to the Reformation. The Reformation began in 1517 when Martin Luther nailed his so-called 95 theses to the door of the church in Wittenberg in Germany. See, that's that act. This he was a Roman Catholic, mind you, at that time. He was a Roman Catholic monk who was a theologian teaching in a Roman Catholic university. So he was so agitated about the wrong teaching and the wrong practices of the Roman Catholic Church. See? And in particular, he was so upset with this man called Tetzel, who was going around selling certificates for the dead, known as indulgences. They say these are certificates from the church. If you can contribute to the church fund, you see, then the moment your shilling goes tinkling in, you see, then the soul of your loved one in hell will out they will spring. You see, as it tinkled in, out they will spring. You see, So the moment you contribute, their souls will spring up from hell to go to heaven. So then you will be given a certificate to prove that you have contributed. So Martin Luther got so very upset with all this, see. And so he wrote down what the Bible taught and what the Church of Rome was wrong about. So 95 articles of faith, you see. And he went there and nailed it to the wall of Wittenberg Church. Early in the morning, people came, hey, why is the church door not open? And what is this notice here? And as they read, you see, point number one, you see, what the Bible teaches and what the Church of Rome is wrong about. Point number two, point number three, 95 of them. Whoa, they talk. And as they talk, the word spread. And soon people get very agitated. They say, what Martin Luther thought was true. And so they began to go on the rampage and then pull down the idols of the church and in people's homes and so on. Martin Luther did not want that to happen, but it happened. See? And along the way, Martin Luther was summoned to Rome and there was an attempt to kill him, but his friend kidnapped him and took him away to a castle in order to keep him safe. And there he translated the Bible into German, and along the way he wrote, and soon he was allowed to come out again and he began to preach. See, he was excommunicated from the Church of Rome, and therefore he was no more a member of the Church of Rome, and his followers became known as Lutherans. So the Lutheran Church was founded. But round about that same time, God was also stirring the hearts of many others, Melanchthon and Zwingli and others, and John Calvin. John Calvin was in France as a student. He was studying the Bible together with others, and along the way he was converted to studying the Bible, and then he began to write what he thought was the Bible's teaching, because he was also one of those very upset with the wrong teaching of the Roman Catholic Church. And soon he was wanted, and because he was wanted by the authorities, he had to run for his life. So he ran to Switzerland, and those of you who know the story, you remember he was met by Pharaoh. His name was already quite well known, so Pharaoh came and met him and invited him to help in the church work in Geneva. See, and John Calvin was so tired. He was running for his life. You know? He's traveled long distance. He was a scholarly man. All he wanted was just to focus on his studies and writing. See, so he turned Pharaoh down. But Pharaoh felt very agitated. You know, the work of God was so much in need of able people, and here was an able man. He said, laborers are so much needed, and here was an able man, clearly a capable man, yeah. And he wanted to retire to focus on his books, you see. So Pharaoh therefore was so angry that he called upon God to curse his learning, if he did not submit to God to help in the work of the church in Geneva. And Calvin said he went home trembling, because he, through the voice of Pharaoh, he somehow heard the word of God speaking to him. He knew his conscience wasn't clear. He knew that he couldn't just allow the gifts God has given him to be squandered in his enjoyment of studies. So that was how he came out of hiding to help Pharaoh and the other reformers. And he soon was a chief preacher in Geneva, and the changes that came through his preaching is a well-known story. So that's John Calvin. So the Reformation is a story in itself, okay? And John Calvin, of course, is known as the systematic theologian of the Reformation, because of his writings. He was able to help the whole Reform movement to understand and state clearly the various aspects of the teaching of the Christian faith. And he revised his biggest works a number of times, his magnum opus, his biggest work. And finally, it became the Institutes of the Christian Religion. The final version was published in 1559. So up to today, the Institute of the Christian Religion is still well known, and in Reformed circles, pastors along the way should at least read some chapters of the Institute of John Calvin. See? Here we... not quite right, to call yourself Reformed, but you never check through John Calvin's Institute. See? the ideal. Of course, if you study through it as one of the systematic theologies that you have studied, many preachers, how do I say it? Reformed preachers mostly would have gone through one volume of systematic theology. I can't say that is the case with other preachers of other communions. We respect them for who they are. They have their own interests, their own emphasis. But I can't speak for them. You see? I fear that many of them have not worked through any good systematic theology book. See? Okay. But a Reformed preacher should at least have worked through one volume of a good systematic theology book. Yeah. I tell you that from early on I saw the importance of this. In the providence of God, I was guided in this. In my ministry, I've gone through at least four different systematic theology books, and it has been helpful. See? And what I'm saying is that this John Calvin's Institute of the Christian Religion is still very helpful today. Those who study it, they will have a good grasp of Reformed theology. But remember, John Calvin was a child of his time as well. He did not get everything right. And one of the things he did not get right was infant baptism. He still retained infant baptism. He argued, twist and turn, and still retaining it. Yeah? Many reformers at that time retained infant baptism. Similarly, they couldn't see clearly the separation of church and state. See, the doctrine of liberty of conscience. See, so these were a few of the important doctrines they failed to see. So it was left to the next generation of reformers, known as the Puritans in Britain, to clarify many other things. And even among the Puritans, the majority of them would still cling on to infant baptism. Even the great John Owen, he argues so strongly on the covenant and on baptism and everything, but he still retained infant baptism. They just couldn't break away from their tradition. See, it took the Baptists to be bold enough. See, even before the time of the Reformation, the Anabaptists and other groups were around. They disagreed with the establishment churches. They believed that baptism should be of believers only and by immersion. At first, they believed in effusion, not sprinkling. Pouring of water. Then later they began to adopt immersion. So the Anabaptists were challenging people like Martin Luther and John Calvin at that time already. See, then in Britain, during the time of the Puritans, the Baptists, both the general Baptists and the particular Baptists, were already challenging the pedobaptist Puritans. Okay? So on this matter. So the Baptists wanted Reformation to be carried on thoroughly, but others held back. So all in all, the Reformation movement resulted in those who are Reformed holding to the certain doctrines of the Bible which characterize them. They are different from those who are not Reformed. And there are five characteristics of Reformed people, Reformed churches today. They hold to what is known as sola scriptura, which means the Bible solely is the authority of faith and practice. Then sola fide, that means faith alone saves. Then sola gratia is by grace alone, not by our effort. Then solus Christus, which means in Christ alone, no addition of anything else. Salvation is by grace through faith in Christ alone. See? The Roman Catholic Church would say, yes, by grace through faith in Christ, but they never say alone. They say, in addition, you must have this, you must have that. You see? So the one word alone is so important. And everything is to the glory of God alone, soli Deo Gloria. Okay? So these then are the slogans of the Reformation. So sola scriptura, sola fide, sola gratia, solus Christus, soli Deo Gloria. But these are not the 5 points of Calvinism. This is where many people wrongly they come to the Reformed faith, they are exposed to the Reformed faith for the first time, they learn of these five characteristics, and along the way they think that these are the 5 points of Calvinism. I said, no, you're mistaken. I said, well, it is good that you are interested in these five solas, but remember, these are the general characteristics of the Reformed movement. They are summarized by these 5 points, okay? 5 points of doctrine. But when we talk about the 5 points of Calvinism, we are talking about something else. We are now talking about the doctrine of salvation. The doctrine of salvation may be summarized by 5 points. And how did these 5 points of Calvinism come about? You must move on to a later period. Remember, the Reformation started with Martin Luther in 1517. He began to spread, Many people were involved. Okay? Now we come to the year 1609. So that is quite some time after the start of the Reformation, but it's still quite near that time. Okay? Now, in the Netherlands, there was this Dutch seminary professor called James Arminius. Some years back, we visited our friends in the Netherlands, and we were brought to this town where Arminius' house is still standing. There is a little house, you know, James Arminius lived there, you know. And of course, why do we visit? It's not because we admire the man. So we come to rebuke you, this man. You know? Now, he was sincere, as far as we know, but he revived the teaching of Pelagius, putting it in his own way. Okay, so he began to teach, and being a seminary professor, he was very influential. Okay? Because most of the established churches have formal training. It's only the persecuted people who did not have formal training. So some of the formally trained people from the establishment churches later joined the dissenting churches, and it benefited the dissenting churches. Among the particular Baptists, for example, there were one or two very well-known leaders who were formally trained. And you need formal training, otherwise you are limited. If you don't have formal training, you don't know Greek, you don't know Hebrew, and you just picked up principles of interpretation by being guided by another pastor along the way, then there's no systematic teaching. See? But the dissenters historically were prevented from studying in the government-controlled seminaries. So what happened is a person like Hansard Knowles, he was a well-known leader amongst the particular Baptists. Before that, he was an Anglican minister, you see. So he has the advantage of being trained formally. The Anglican ministers used to be trained either in Oxford or in Cambridge. So up to today, Oxford and Cambridge has strong theological faculties. Yeah? So when these well-trained preachers, they defected from their studies, they come to realize that the state churches were wrong on infant baptism and on many things. So they couldn't agree with the Anglican system of prayer and so on. So they were ejected. So when they were ejected, they joined the particular Baptist. So Hansard Knowles was one of those, you see. And one or two others. There were a few of the, very few of those who were properly trained people. So because they have the advantage in their earlier years of being trained. So this is the situation in those days. Right? And in the Netherlands, Arminius trained many people. And these students, they continued to agitate the church after Arminius died. They were in influential positions, you see. So through their teaching and through their writing, they began to come up with so-called 5 points of Arminianism. They were using the name of their mentor, the leader, Arminius, who had passed away, but they said, these are the 5 points of Arminianism. And what are the 5 points? We are going to study them one by one and see why they are wrong, see what is the right teaching of the Bible. But they basically revive the teaching of Pelagius. Okay, basically teaching that man has free will, that there's no such thing as original sin, and then that, you see, human beings are able to make decisions to be safe. Right? So they came up with 5 points, and because it agitated the church in the Netherlands, and remember in those days, the Netherlands had quite a lot of interaction with England. So when Christians are persecuted in England, they will run to Holland. In Holland, they were persecuted, they will run to England. That was what happened. So a group of Anabaptists, big group of Anabaptists in Holland, for example, ran and settled in England. Okay? And later, when the Baptists arose separately, they were confused with the Anabaptists who were from Holland. Yeah. Holland is one big part of the Netherlands. So today, don't call the country Holland, okay? Because the people will be upset. They say, no, Netherlands is bigger than Holland. So don't call Britain, confuse Britain with England. England is only part of Britain. Huh? So Britain is England, Wales, Scotland, and Northern Ireland. So together they form Britain, or Great Britain, or United Kingdom. Okay? So Netherlands, one big part was Holland. Okay? So we say the Dutch people. Okay? So generally, because they are the big group, we say the Dutch people. The Dutch people from the Netherlands, they had much interaction with the British. And of course, there were times when they would quarrel as well. There was one stage when they fought one another. And the Dutch like to tell the story of how they secretly went up the River Thames without knowledge of the British. You see? So the British never like to tell that story because it's an embarrassing situation. But you ask the Dutch, they will tell you that story. Okay? So each joke at one another. Huh? For example, okay, we cut that out. Okay, but we come back to the relationship between the British and the people in the Netherlands. The situation in Netherlands affected the situation in Britain as well, okay? And it affected other parts of Europe. And so when the National Synod was called by the Dutch Reformed Church, they invited Christian leaders from other countries nearby. So a total of 26 delegates from 8 other countries came to join the synod that was meeting to discuss Arminius' teaching. And of course, after many months of discussion, they came to the conclusion that Arminius' teaching was against the Bible's teaching. It was basically a revival of Pelagius' teaching. And they therefore came up with 5 points to counter the 5 points of Arminianism. So the 5 points that the Synod of Dort came up with later became known as the 5 points of Calvinism. Where was Calvin at that time? He was already dead. He's no more around. But the name Calvinism is used because Calvin was the theologian of the Reformation. His institutes of the Christian religion had clearly explained the doctrine of salvation. But now, because of the way Arminius' followers put the 5 points of the doctrine of salvation, those who hold to the orthodox, the traditional biblical teaching, had to summarize it in 5 points to show that those of Arminius were wrong. So the 5 points of the Synod of Dort became nicknamed as the 5 points of Calvinism. Okay? So that roughly is the history. So the full document is called this Canons of Dort, the Canons of Dort. It does not just put down 5 points, no, it explains the doctrine of salvation, and then point for point that was raised by Arminius, it counters. Then later on, the whole document known as the Canon of Dort, which is the confession, part of the confession of faith of many Reformed churches today. So what happened is that the teaching in that Canon of Dort was summarized as 5 points that are against the 5 points of Arminianism. Then the name of Calvin came in, the 5 points of Calvinism, which is against the 5 points of Arminianism. So with that story, I hope it stirs up your interest. And stories generally are interesting, but we must learn the right things out of stories. But when we come to the actual doctrine, let us understand that the doctrine had history behind it. And doctrine, it is important to be clear about doctrine. Okay, are there questions or comments?